Well, thank you and good afternoon, everyone. I was being interviewed a few months ago, and the person interviewing me asked me this question. He asked me for a one-word summary of everything that was going on at the moment. And yep, that was my reaction as well. How could you possibly distill all those moving parts down to the one word? And then it did occur to me there was a word that captured everything that was going on. We've already heard it. And that word is uncertainty. It's a very useful word to describe what's going on over the last year. I think it's going to be a very useful word to think about as we move through the next year as well. And we certainly climbed a wall of worry when you think about the last 12 months. And we've discovered that uncertainty theme can have an impact on economies, and it can certainly have a big impact on financial markets as well. So what do we actually worry about? Well, there have been many concerns, and I've just picked a selection of them on this particular chart. So it shows you some of the things that we've been searching for on Google over the last year or so. Some of the obvious things like trade wars, Brexit, and so on. Some of them are more exotic related to financial markets like negative yields, inverse yield curves, and so on. But where they all really kind of cross over, I suppose, is an elevated concern about a global recession. And I think we actually came pretty close to that over the last year, and of course we're skirting around the edges of it again as we move through this year. The problem that we've discovered is that in uncertain times, businesses tend to put off their capital spending plans, and consumers put off their purchases of big ticket items like motor vehicles and so on. And of course, if enough people do that, it does have a real effect. And you can see the story, I think, on the chart on the left-hand side here. That red line on that particular chart is a measure of global uncertainty. As it goes down, it means uncertainty is going up. Well, as we move through the last year or so, what we saw, of course, was a big slowdown in consumer spending on durables in the major economies, and businesses pretty much stopped investing in things like machinery and equipment. So real economic effect coming through there. What we also discovered is that all those consumer durables and business investment goods are actually made. So if you move to the chart on the right-hand side, you can see that global industrial production nosedived as that uncertainty story played out. And of course, we also discovered that most of global trade is in fact consumer durables and business investment goods again. So global trade plunged. And if you were just looking at that chart, these are the sort of numbers you would expect to see in a global recession. That's why I say I think we came pretty close to it in 2019. And there is another outcome that's pretty important to the financial market part of the story, and that is that same uncertainty theme tends to encourage people to save more. So we've seen a big shift in the global balance between investment spending and the supply savings that we normally use to fund that investment. And again, for the major economies, you can see the story on this chart. Pretty weak investment spending, savings running ahead of that investment spending. And this is Economics 101. What it's basically saying, I suppose, is the supply of money is exceeding the demand for that money at the moment. The price has to adjust. The price is interest rates. And of course, interest rates have moved very low everywhere and are likely to remain low for an extended period. So this is kind of the fundamental factor behind that. And as I say, you can trace a lot of it back to that uncertainty theme once again. What it means, of course, is financial markets, you tend to see pursuit of yield, you tend to see pursuit of capital gains, and that can lead to a lift in market volatility, very much as we're seeing right now. The concern I have about this part of the story, though, is interest rates have been low for long enough now that we're starting to see households move down the same path. They're essentially taking on more risk to try and generate some income against that very low interest rate backdrop. And that's something that we haven't really seen before. So a new risk in the environment to keep in mind for the year ahead. Now, by the end of last year, early this year, it's fair to say a lot of those uncertainty themes were actually starting to disappear. We had a trade deal between the US and China. Brexit had actually happened and so on, but clearly nature abhors a vacuum, because in a very short space of time, we've had a series of near biblical events with bushfires, smoke, virus, and of course floods as well in some areas. So uncertainty is on the rise again. And what you're also seeing, I think, is something of a competition amongst economic commentators to see who can come up with the most negative scenario based on their complete lack of knowledge about what is actually happening in a lot of these events. Now, I'm going to play the same game, but my general theme here is that what you're really seeing in the headlines is, in a sense, the gross negatives, without much allowance for some of the offsetting factors that will reduce the net effect on the economy, I think. So firstly, we think about the bushfires, and it seems like a dim and distant memory now, I suppose, but it wasn't that long ago, and the effects there are still obviously playing out. What we've done is we've mapped some of the economic data onto the regions that were most affected by the bushfires, and you can see some of that on this chart here, and the regions on the bottom, mainly in Victoria and New South Wales, of course. Well, those bushfire-affected regions account for about 3.5% of Australian GDP, 3.8% of employment. So the calculations are pretty simple. Every 10% drop in activity in those areas will knock about 0.3% off Australian GDP growth. And that's the sort of number that you tend to see around the place, spread over a couple of quarters. What's happening, though, or what is ignored, I think, is the structure of these regions is a bit different from the economy overall. And in that structure, I think, is where some of these offsets will come through. And this chart here gives you a bit of a snapshot of what the regional structure looks like. And the conclusions from this are basically nearly a third of employment in these regions is what you could think of as public sector related employment. So these people still have their jobs, they're still getting paid every fortnight, they're probably busier than ever. Close to another 10% is involved in construction. Well, they clearly will be very busy if they're not already. It's only when you get further down the list, there's around about 20% of these regions that you could think of as exposed to the kind of tourism and consumer part of the story. And that's the bit where the real negatives are going to be concentrated, of course. So if you kind of start scaling back that gross figure about the bushfire effect based on that, I think. Of course, it's that kind of tourism story where we start to overlap with our current concern about the coronavirus as well. So along with those kind of geopolitical events that we've been worried about for a few years now, we now have to worry about some of these geomedical issues, as people are starting to call it. And they work the same way as that uncertainty theme. Uncertainty lifts, people cut back their spending, they adopt precautionary motives. We're going to see disruptions to supply chains, of course. We're going to see impacts on specific sectors like tourism and education, and lower commodity prices that obviously feeds into the mix for Australia as well. Now, the situation here is evolving, and it really is just a case of a best guess about the impact at the moment. And I've just picked out on this particular table, maybe hard to read, but it's some work by Professor Warwick McKibben, and I've focused on his analysis, mainly because he's very, very smart, and he used to be on the board of the Reserve Bank. So I suspect this is the kind of analysis that they're looking at when they're deciding what's going to happen with interest rates and the like. Essentially, what he's done here is just for a range of scenarios of increasing spread of the coronavirus, increasing mortality rates as you move from left to right in that table, and what the kind of impact on a range of economies will be. So if you look at scenario 6 there, that's the worst case scenario. And what it's saying is, well, Australian GDP could be 8% lower this year than it would have been otherwise. The global economy would lose something like $9 trillion US dollars from its activity. So a very, very negative impact in that worst case scenario. Now, the reality is probably going to be somewhere to the left there. What sort of numbers should we be thinking about? Well, I think part of the message there is the charts here. So the chart on the right-hand side, the two sectors most affected are going to be education, international education, and tourism. They account for around about 5% of GDP in Australia. So on that same kind of metric, a 10% drop is going to knock about 0.5% off GDP growth. These are the sort of numbers you hear. What does have the risk of kind of magnifying the impact, though, is just the kind of fear whipped up. And this is an age of social media, and it's not for nothing that people like the World Health Organization now talk about an infodemic as well as an epidemic. And by that, they mean there is so much information out there, a lot of it's contradictory, a lot of it's wrong, but it does whip up this level of fear. So having some sort of gauge where we can actually monitor that is very useful, and I put a suggestion up there on the left-hand side, very simple one. It's just search activity for the word coronavirus.
And clearly, that kind of fear gauge, if you like, is running at a panic at the moment, and perhaps explains our obsession with toilet paper at this point as well. So watching this fear gauge, I think, will give you an idea about the likely magnitude of the effects. Now, we start to look at some of the specifics here. Tourism, obviously, and the main focus is on the lack of foreign tourists coming to Australia for a holiday. And we've certainly seen this response before to medical crises, economic crises, less people come to Australia. And you can see that on the chart on the left-hand side here. Shows you what happens with tourist arrivals around various major events that I picked out. If we just look at the red line, the SARS line, for example, big drop in foreign tourists coming here, as you'd expect, as we're seeing now. What gets missed in the analysis, though, I think, is there are far more Australians who go on overseas holidays than foreigners who come here for a holiday, and they're going to stop going overseas as well. The chart on the right-hand side shows you people leaving Australia to go on those foreign holidays. The red line again, what happened around the time of SARS, big drop off. Now, those people who are no longer going on an overseas holiday decide to have one in Australia, then that's going to be a pretty powerful offset to the loss of foreign tourists coming here. And I noticed a few days ago one of the hotel research groups published some numbers showing that occupancy rates in Australian hotels have actually gone up since the 1st of January, so presumably picking up some of that conversion from foreign holidays. Our major events also have an impact on education flows, and the chart on the left-hand side here, it's the same story. It shows you what happens to people coming to Australia around those same events for education purposes. And what stands out is these flows tend to be a lot more resilient. They level out rather than decline typically. And I guess that makes sense because you can decide tomorrow to go somewhere else for a holiday, but if you're in your year two of your university degree, then it's a bit hard to shift horses mid-course, so to speak. So I think that kind of limits the damage to that part of the story over time. It will play out that way. And what's also important, I think, is the chart on the right-hand side there, which shows you the top five reasons that international students come to Australia. And it's all to do with the quality of the education that they can get here. Those factors will be there next week, next month, and next year as well, I think. Where these sort of stories really play into the broader mix, though, I think, is the big domestic risk for a long time has been the Australian consumer and the weakness that we're seeing in consumer spending. These sort of factors are a new risk in that part of the story. And you can see the big picture here. So the brown line, consumer spending, it's slowed sharply. It's running at the sort of rates that we last saw at the height of the GFC. It's being accentuated at the moment by the fact that there's a big downturn in residential construction activity that's impacting on the household sector as well, as you can see on the green line on that chart. Now, these are the reasons the Reserve Bank's been cutting interest rates while we had tax rebates and, of course, why there's more stimulus coming through. So how is this actually playing out in that consumer story right now? Well, one way of looking at this is some of the new indicators that we're constructing at the Commonwealth Bank. And we've basically developed measures of household spending intentions for a range of sectors in the economy. And I pulled out some of the results on the set of charts here. So the one on the left-hand side, the blue line, it's kind of when I add all these different measures into the one overall measure. You get that, and it's picked up a little bit. But you'd have to say it's a pretty weak response given the fact that we have had those interest rate cuts, that we have had those tax rebates, and we've had a pretty solid labour market as well. There's some indications here, I think, that policy is not working as effectively as it is, or as it used to, rather. One exception, though, is when you move to the middle chart, where the pink line shows you home buying intentions. Well, they've responded exactly the way you would expect with lower interest rates and so on. They're running at record highs at the moment and certainly indicate further house price gains to come. And it's remarkable, I think, if look at Melbourne, house prices in Melbourne are already back to their previous peak. They'll be back to their previous peak in Sydney in a couple of months' time. It's the fastest turnaround that we've had in the housing market since at least 1980. It does raise the possibility that we'll see a positive wealth effect that might help the consumer part of the story as we move through this year. What's a bit more concerning, though, is the final panel in that set, which looks at spending intentions for travel and education. And you can see pretty clearly the slowdown that's occurring there. So there will be a real economic effect from what's going on in those sectors at the moment. My caution, again, is just that it won't be as big as some of the negative headlines would suggest. So what can policymakers do to help? Well, economists, when they're asked this question, typically resort to the three Ps, and they are population, productivity, and participation. These are the sorts of things that basically govern how fast economies can grow, how many jobs they can generate, how much income they provide, and so on. And here's what the three Ps look like in Australia right now. So we're actually seeing pretty solid growth in one of those Ps, population. Participation in the labour force, the red line there, is running at a record high. But clearly the standout is the weakness that we've seen in the productivity part of the story. So policy needs to focus on measures over time to get that productivity back up, because, as I say, that's what's going to drive potential growth. It's what's going to drive the income we need to deal with an ageing population. And in the end, it's the only thing that's going to drive sustainable increases in real wages, which, of course, is what we need to deal with that consumer risk that we're facing at the moment. So we know what to do. How do we do it? Well, every economist's favourite answer there is infrastructure. It's great at generating productivity. Trouble is at the moment is there are so many big projects underway that it's going to be hard to add much to that mix. But I think rather than going big, the thing to do at the moment is to go small. And what stands out when you look at the numbers is that a lot of local government infrastructure is no longer fit for purpose. It is in fact a negative for the productivity story. What this chart is telling you is there's about $30 billion worth of local government infrastructure in poor condition around Australia. Plenty of small projects that we could focus on. They're largely in rural and regional areas, which could clearly do with some assistance right now. Maybe that's what we should be focusing. We are seeing the Reserve Bank on the job. They cut interest rates last week. We think they're going to cut interest rates again when they next meet in April. And certainly at that point, they're going to start considering unconventional monetary policies. And in fact, we heard the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank this morning talking about those very, very measures designed to get interest rates even lower than they can with just the traditional tools. And very clearly, we're going to get some sort of fiscal stimulus coming through, and we'll see some sort of announcement later this week as well that should also help the story. But we shouldn't lose focus on the medium term here either, because there are things that we can do with the kind of mix of taxing and spending in Australia that will help the productivity story. And what I have in mind is this particular chart. It shows you how our kind of tax regime stacks up against the average OECD economy. And what it's telling you is that we're kind of overweight, if you like, taxes on income and companies, underweight taxes on consumption. Now, some of those income taxes are actually quite negative from a productivity perspective. We can rebalance the mix there and help this broader productivity story, I think. It certainly suggests that the company tax debate needs to be restarted in Australia. Now, we're going to ask the government to use its good balance sheet to help the broader cause here. And I think it's also fair to ask the other part of the Australian economy whose balance sheets are in pretty good shape at the moment, and that is the business sector. So this chart here, it just shows you the aggregate picture of corporate balance sheets, shows you the gearing is pretty low, debt servicing is very low at the moment, and I can understand the reluctance to invest in this uncertain environment, as I've been talking about. Nevertheless, the opportunities are there, and we should be taking advantage of those. Now, in this age of uncertainty, the one thing I am certain of is I've used up my allocated time, and I'll stop at this point, and obviously look forward to your questions when we get through to the panel session. Thank you very much.